Hello and welcome to Volume 106 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the damage being caused by the pine tip moth, and we'll discuss the environmental and economic impact that Alabama forests have. We'll talk about a person who advocates in favor of charging recreational fees on public lands, and we'll check in on the stumpage market. I'm Hayes Brown of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He argues that Congress should allow federal land agencies like national parks to charge market rates for using these public lands. He's Randall O'Toole. Welcome, Randall.
Glad to be here.
People already support these public lands through their taxes. Won't charging these recreation fees on top of that be something like double taxation?
Well, I like to say that when you pay a tax, somebody else gets what you pay for. When you pay a user fee, you get what you pay for. So, yes, we pay taxes, and tax dollars do support the public lands, but that doesn't mean that those dollars are going for things that you want. If you're a recreationist and you find out your tax dollars are being used to subsidize mining or grazing or timber cutting or other things that interfere with your recreation, it might be kind of upsetting, and that's actually what happens. So, by paying a recreation fee and having those fees or some of those fees go to the agency you're paying, you're giving the agency an incentive to give you what you want, and that's really a good thing for recreationists.
I believe you hold the view that recreationists actually benefit from public land charging recreation fees. What is your argument for that?
Well, there's two benefits from that. First of all, if the recreationists are charging fees, if the agencies are charging fees, and they are allowed to keep some of that money, they will have both the finances and the incentives to provide enhanced recreation experiences for people. They'll have better facilities, they'll have new opportunities, and things like that. The second big advantage is where private landowners come in. In the West, where I live, about half the land is federal. And so the federal government essentially sets the price for recreation. If they set a price of zero, private landowners can't charge. And as a result, private landowners have no incentive to provide recreation opportunities for people. If the Forest Service and Park Service and other agencies charge, then we'll see private landowners charging as well, and we'll have essentially double our recreation opportunities. Now, in the South, where there's less federal land, the federal government doesn't set the price as much, but by charging fees, they'll be able to relieve the competition against private landowners who want to charge fees and provide better opportunities for people.
How much do you think a typical fee would be, and how much money are we talking about?
Well, typical fees might be on the order of $10 a day. I wouldn't say typical. I'd say average fees. Mm-hmm. But they could range anywhere from a dollar a day for very common forms of recreation to well over $100 a day for hunting certain big game animals or fishing in premier fly fishing streams. And the thing is, with all the public lands we have, there will be plenty of opportunities for people. Now, the Forest Service estimates that on its lands, recreation fees could bring in three times as much money as all other resources combined. And that sounds like a lot of money. It'd be billions of dollars a year. But when you consider that outdoor recreationists spend well over $600 billion a year already on equipment, on food, on travel, this is only going to add maybe 1% or 2% to their expenses, and it's not going to break anybody's budget.
All right. Well, thank you, Randall. We appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Our next guest is Dave Tenney, the president and CEO of NAFO, which is an organization of private forest landowners that serves as an advocate for these private forest landowners. I think we last interviewed Dave in January of 2010. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you, Hayes. Good to be with you.
Your organization has helped many people quantify the impact that forests have on the economy. First, just tell us why this economic impact data is important to forest landowners.
Well, I think we start from the premise that, trees don't vote, but they affect a lot of people who do. And so one thing that we've learned is that lawmakers pay close attention to the economy. It's a bellwether of quality of life for their constituents. It affects the political mood of the electorate, and because of that, it's important to elected officials. So by helping them understand the economic footprint of forest owners, we're also helping them understand how policy affecting that footprint will affect their constituents and in many ways their own political fortunes. So that's why we think this is an important piece of information to use.
What's the significance of the Alabama data, and how can we use that to maintain our working forests?
Well, if you look at the way the report is organized, it provides both total numbers for Alabama in key indicators like jobs and payroll, sales, and the percent of total manufacturing, but it also breaks this data down in to a per 1,000-acre basis. And what this does is it helps individual landowners or counties or other subdivisions of the total forest owner population extrapolate that data and tell the story of their individual or their relative economic impact in the state. I'll just give you an example. Total in Alabama, we have about 23 million acres of timberland, and that supports about 144,000 jobs, a little bit more, and a payroll of about $5.2 billion annually. And that tells a story about Alabama as a whole. But if you look at that on a per 1,000-acre basis, each 1,000 acres of forest land in the state supports 6.5 jobs and $236,000 in payroll. And that doesn't mean that every acre is supporting or every 1,000 acres is supporting those jobs and those paychecks all the time. But what it does mean is if that acreage doesn't exist anymore, if that's not there anymore, then 6.5 fewer jobs and $236,000 less in payroll will be sustained over time. And that makes that land all the more relevant as you're telling your story to a policymaker, especially if you're a group of landowners, or if you're a landowner that has a lot of acres, or you're a county that has a lot of acres in it, or a state as a whole.
Okay. How does your organization, NAFO, use this data in advocacy?
Well, we use this to tell the story, much the same as an individual landowner would. It helps us paint a picture for a policymaker, whether it's a senator who represents a whole state or an individual member of Congress who represents a part of the state. It helps us incorporate economic consequence into our advocacy. It just sort of rolls off the tongue as we talk about the importance of forestry in the state, and it resonates with the policymakers that we talk to. And then individual NAFO member companies use this data to tell their own story as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dave. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Our next guest will continue a thread that we started at our annual meeting last April, and that's how quality pole timber can significantly affect your bottom line. Dr. Stephen Dickey is an extension professor at Mississippi State. Welcome, Dr. Dickey.
Thank you, Hayes. Thank you for having me on your program.
Why should owners of loblolly pine plantations be interested in poles?
Well, back in the 1980s, that one-and-a-half and second-generation loblolly pine plantations, they had some quality in there. Many of those stands are now string-lined straight, have small branches, good branch angles. They're, who'd have thunk it, loblolly pine perfect for poles.
Mm-hmm.
Poles have been a very steady market here in the southeast. It looks like it was good for the future. 90% of the poles are wood in our market, so we think the future is really good for poles. Poles are our most valuable product that we have here in the southeast, 50% higher than saw timber. And it's got a very dependable price. Its variation from month to month is only half of saw timber. CV is 9%, which is twice as good as saw timber. So good market, good future, a very dependable price. I think people should evaluate their pine plantations for poles.
All right. How do you manage for poles?
Well, to start off with is that genetics. If someone's starting off with a new plantation, they ought to think about investing in some good genetics where the trees are straighter, have better branch angles, have smaller branches than the average loblolly pine tree. And then once they're established, you need to wait on that first inning. That really screws up a stand if you do an early first inning. Mm-hmm. So delay the first inning till you kill limbs to at least 24 feet. Do a light thinning, maybe basal areas of 90 or maybe down to 80. A fourth row or fifth row thinning. Have a forester oversee it so it's not screwed up by the logging operation. And then lastly, it takes time to grow a pole, probably 25 or 35 years at the minimum. You've got to have a certain diameter, like a number 5 pole takes 12 inches in diameter minimum. A number 4 pole takes a 14-inch diameter tree. We're talking 60 to 75-foot tall trees. So it just takes time and quality to get those poles available for market.
How are they marketed?
Well, it takes about 15 tons of the acre to sell poles separately in a market. And typically, pole buyers will want to mark their own trees. And so if you're trying to sell, like, 12-inch diameter trees, that's the number 5 poles, you're going to have 30 of those trees to the acre to be able to sell those separately, 20 trees an acre, 14-inch poles, and 15 trees an acre, 16-inch diameter poles. So it takes a lot of trees an acre to make a pole buyer happy to come in there and mark them. And then how do you sell it? They actually mark the trees, and then you finish up your final harvest typically, and then they come and harvest their poles. So the poles are standing there during the normal harvest, timber harvest operation. But some consultants will mark those poles at age, 25 or 30, do a second thinning pole cut. That's the consultant's advice, which time to sell, whether at age 25 or age 35. That you go with your consultant on that. Do everything right, you probably will make $300 to $500 more an acre by managing for these poles.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Dickey. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Chris Johnson is with International Forest Company, which produces pine seedlings for many forest owners. He's been letting people know how to handle the pine tip moth in seedlings. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Hayes. Glad to be here.
First, give us a brief background on pine tip moth and the damage that it causes.
The Nantucket pine tip moth is a very small insect that can severely damage recently planted or young natural pine seedlings. The range for the tip moth occurs from Massachusetts, south to Florida, and then west to Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas, and even stretches out to California. The tip moth generally has about 2 to 5 generations per year, and each generation poses a threat to the newly planted pines. The adult moths first emerge in February through mid-March. They lay their eggs on the newly developed foliage, and when the eggs hatch, the larvae usually feed on the surface of the new tender needles. After continuing to grow, the larvae start to feed on the new shoots and buds of the young pines, causing loss of the tree's form, and heavy attacks by the pine tip moth can also cause forks, crooks, and multiple trunks. The larvae then pupate within the infested shoots and buds to repeat the life cycle at a 6 to 8 week interval.
Okay. Now, we understand that BASF Chemical Company has a treatment for this pine tip moth. How has it been used in the past?
Well, there's actually been two ways application they've used in the past. There's been a foliar application, and in the past, the typical way the pine tip moth was controlled with this application was by season-long control using insecticide sprays, with applications being necessary for each generation. This means 2 to 5 treatments per year, which could be difficult to predict as the effectiveness of the insecticide is dependent on the precise timing of spraying. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, the insecticide is dependent on the precise timing of spraying. Ordinarily, the pheromone-baited traps have been used to determine the time of spraying. This type of control will last for one growing season. And what we have now with BAS coming out, they have a systemic application, and this way has been used to control the tip moths by applying the PTM after the seedlings are planted using soil injectors.
Okay. And your company... You go ahead. Mm-hmm.
The active ingredient in the PTM chemical is fipronil, which is the same chemical as found in your pet's flea collars. And this chemical application method is very effective, but the treatment costs are high due to the amount of labor needed to apply it to the already planted seedlings. This method of treatment will control the tip moth for 2 years with no infestations. Using this type of application, research shows that loblolly pine trees that are not protected by the PTM injections are 9 feet shorter in height, 1.5 inches smaller in diameter, and had about 25% as much wood as a pine that was protected with PTM at 10 years of age.
Now, your company is offering to inject containerized seedlings to treat for PTM. How does that work, and what are the results you're inspecting? You're expecting?
What we're seeing here at International Forest Company is we've been able to accomplish to directly inject this PTM chemical into the root ball of our container seedlings.
Mm-hmm.
And we do this before they leave the nursery. And this eliminates any additional labor costs because the seedlings are transplanted as any other container seedlings would be planted. And we expect to control the tip moth for about 2 years with this process and at approximately about half the cost per acre compared to injecting the soil.
Okay. Well, good. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Dove hunting season is just around the corner, and we thought we'd check in with Kevin Dodd, who's the Chief Enforcement Officer of the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Hayes. Thank you.
We've heard some reports of people getting charged for hunting over baited fields. How do you properly prepare a field within the legal standards?
Well, yeah, that's always been a point of contention. A lot of folks really worried about running afoul of the law. And you got to understand that doves are migratory, and they travel from, you know, some reaches in Canada all the way to the Florida Keys. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, are the ones that oversee the management of these birds. They want to make sure they're equally distributed. It's a public resource, but it needs to be equally distributed across all the states. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sets legal hunting methods for mourning doves, and they have an excellent website that I think y'all have posted on your website on what's legal or how to hunt legally for mourning doves. Now, it references, you know, that they can be hunted over normal agricultural operations and practices, but that varies tremendously from state to state. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not the expert when it comes to agricultural practices, so they defer to the individual state cooperative extension systems. And the cooperative extension systems normally produce brochures or recommendations on what constitutes normal practices in each individual state.
Okay.
So by following those recommendations is the best way to keep from running afoul.
All right. What if you're an individual hunter and you're invited on a property and you're not sure that the field is a legal field? What do you recommend that people do?
Well, it used to, it was called a strict liability. If you were in a bad place or a baited place, you were ticketed regardless of your knowledge or your participation in the baiting activity.
Mm-hmm.
The courts have changed that, and it's to the hunter's advantage. We think it's a much fairer situation. The person that prepares the field assumes some liability or most of the liability. The individual hunter, if he goes onto the field and does a brief inspection and doesn't see anything out of the way, then he's pretty much covered. If he sees something that doesn't seem right, you know, if they're planting cracked corn, which, you know, is not a normal practice at any time, then he probably needs to question the landowner, how did that cracked corn get here? And if it's not a legitimate reason, he needs to leave. One thing that all hunters and landowners could do is access the Extension Service website. And there is a new brochure, which we're really trying to push because it is very advantageous to landowners and hunters. The Extension Service in Alabama has produced a new brochure that pretty much liberalized some of the recommended practices for fall planting of wheat. And that's generally where most of the conflicts come into play. Growing sunflowers or corn on the field, you can manipulate it any way you see fit. But planting in the fall during dove season is generally where the conflicts come up. So by accessing this brochure, which is also shown on your website, hunters and landowners alike can make sure they're within the confines of what's allowed.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
With the recent wildfires in Colorado, a lot of media attention has been placed on keeping a defensible space around homes that are built in rural environments. We've asked Angela Thorpe with State Farm Insurance Company to provide some guidelines. Hello, Angela.
Hi, Hayes. Thanks for having me.
When it comes to wildfire, what is State Farm's recommendation?
Well, there's three main areas that we focus on, and first and foremost, it really is making sure that you're properly insured and that you understand the insurance coverage that you have. And we recommend that people visit with their agent at least once a year, do an insurance checkup, make sure that the coverage that you bought, let's say 5, 10, 15 years ago, is still going to work for you today. And really what we recommend is for the coverage that you have, it is at least 100% of the replacement cost. of the materials, building, construction needed to rebuild your home, the things that you've lost in the event that you lose everything. Something else that we recommend is that people complete a home inventory. It's a tedious task, we understand, but when you complete that today, when you need it, you'll be happy that you did it. A good way to think about that is, even on our best day, to recall everything that we own would be difficult. So think about having gone through something tragic and then having to sit down and relive everything you've lost. I assure you, getting your home inventory done today will save you time tomorrow. And then finally, when we talk about defensible space, right, the best way to protect you and your home from a wildfire is it's really to remove or reduce the potential fuel. And we recommend within a 30-feet safety zone around your home. Now, if you're in a high-risk area, you want to increase that safety zone to around 100 feet. And we have a lot of recommendations that we have online that your listeners can reference. Working with your local fire department or your forest agencies through FireWise Communities is a great organization. Look into what recommendations they may make for you and your community locally, and you can find out a better way to improve the area around your home for your safety, your family, and if there is a fire, the safety of firefighters.
Let me ask you this. You're focusing on things that homeowners do for themselves and not waiting on someone to do something for you. Why do you think it's important for people to take action to create these spaces that protect their homes?
Well, there's a few reasons, and first and foremost, safety. I'll say it again and again and again. There's so many unpredictable factors that play into wildfire, as we've seen. And when there's just moments to get out, or firefighters or are trying to save your property, safety is first and foremost. But when we look at Mother Nature, she has a very big broom. And if we aren't better stewards of our property, then she will clean house. So ways to mitigate your own risk is in your best interest. And let me share a little story with you. For those people who have taken the recommendations that State Farm has made, for example, through a program we have for people to reduce their risk, they've at first maybe had a little heartburn that they needed to do so much work, but when they were done, they were the envy of their neighbors. Everyone wanted to clean up their yards because their yards looked beautiful, you know, spacing those trees, clearing those fuels away from the house, clearing debris away from the home. It not only creates a safe zone, but it's rather attractive as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Angela. Our next guest wrote a book with a provocative title. She's Roberta Brzezinski, and the title of the book is Why Would Anyone Cut Down a Tree? Welcome, Roberta.
Hello, thank you.
What motivated you to write this book?
Actually, it was conversations with elementary students that gave me the idea for the book. I found out that students know all the benefits that trees offer, yet someone would pipe up, "You can never cut a tree down." So the teacher in me wanted to address that information gap. So I researched existing children's books, probably read about 200 of them, and didn't find the information. So I proposed a children's picture book as a way to address it. And interesting, a manager commented that some adults needed the message as well.
And what message do you hope your readers will take from the book?
There are a few things, actually. First, I do reinforce the idea that, yes, trees are great. They offer many benefits as living trees. And then the following really important point is that we don't want to cut trees, but sometimes we just have to. And some of those reasons are trees are living things, and they're not going to live forever. With storm damage or age, they can become a safety hazard. And as Angela Thorpe just mentioned, they can pose a fire hazard as well. Sometimes they get diseases or insects that can spread to other trees. Sometimes they can be too crowded for for the forest to grow well. And the thinning has also been mentioned on this program. Mm-hmm. And there's always cutting trees to get wood. And sometimes when it's necessary to cut trees for other purposes, the wood can be used as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I wanted... I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, financial maturity, tree is financially ready to be cut.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the last thing I wanted to offer is hope or consolation, if you will, that though trees have to be cut, they are a renewable resource. So I want the readers to understand the tree life cycle. I'd actually had kids comment that they didn't know that trees could replant themselves or that seeds would naturally sprout, and reinforce the point that people can plant more trees.
Yeah. How do you get a copy of the book?
You can get it in a couple ways. It can be downloaded from the Internet for free, and sometimes it takes a while because there are gorgeous full-color illustrations by Juliet Watts throughout the book. If you're having a problem, we have found sometimes it goes faster in the morning when the whole country isn't yet on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also purchase already printed copies from the government printing office. There is a link to their bookstore. If you do go on there, you'll see that the book is noted as being backordered. I would encourage you, if you want copies, to place an order anyway, because once GPO sees that the requests are coming in, that will stimulate them to print more.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Roberta. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
In our markets chair is Billy Rye, a forestry consultant in Alabama. Welcome, Billy.
Good to be here, Hayes.
Here, hardwood markets are hot, trending upward. What are you seeing?
Yeah, they're exceptionally good at this time. We were first tipped off by some of the buyers from outside of the southeastern United States, primarily the Midwest and the Appalachians. And shortly thereafter, we began to receive some phone calls from area buyers looking for hardwood tracks. So we decided to test the market, put a couple of tracks up for sale. Had one we opened the bids on last Thursday that we had appraised at $98,000 back in 2006 for a tax basis. And we sold it for $176,000 this past Thursday. So if you do the math, that's about an 80% increase. Realistically, it's more like 50% because the appraised was based on average prices paid, which consultants typically get more.
That's in the summer, too, right?
That's in the summer. That's a good point because these are arguably the all-time high prices for hardwood sawtimber products in the summer.
Okay. Now, are all hardwood markets improving, or is it just relate to certain products?
Generally, they're all up. White oak in particular is a hot item. In fact, the prices are approaching walnut prices, but ash poplar, even red oak are up. The tie logs are doing exceptionally well, and even hardwood pulpwood is up at the moment.
Okay. Some people intensively manage their timber for pine. What does the pine market look like?
Well, unfortunately, that's the downer in the market report. Most of the markets throughout the state of Alabama are low, continue to be low, and in fact, most of the markets for most of the products are actually below where they were this time last year. There are some good outlooks for middle-sized pine, the chip and saw, as well as the big pine, the pine saw timber. They're expected to recover sometime in the near future, but as of today, they have not. Any price recovery in these products will probably be more gradual in nature over the next couple of years as we see supply shift southward. Prices for pine pulpwood even remain low throughout the state at this time.
All right. Under those conditions, should forest landowners postpone commercial thinnings because prices are low?
That really depends. It depends on a lot of variables. You know, it can depend on your soil, your planting density, your survival rates, even your landowner objectives. The bottom line is they need to talk to their local forester. Most of your financial and your growth and yield software computer programs that are written to help you make decisions on when to thin, most of them will tell you it's better to thin early regardless of what the pine pulpwood markets are like, even though that is the predominant product that you'll be removing. So you really need to have a good relationship with a consultant forester that can look at your resources, look at your objectives, and advise you. That we recommend a consultant forester who's members of the Association of Consulting Foresters, which has certain educational and ethical requirements to be a member of that organization. So be in contact with your local professional before you make a decision to postpone or to proceed with a pine thinning.
All right. Well, thank you, Billy. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Randall O'Toole, Dave Tenney, Stephen Dickey, and Chris Johnston. We also appreciate the contributions of Kevin Dodd, Angela Thorpe, Roberta Brzezinski, and Billy Wright. Charging fees for using public land is a controversial topic, but what if you owned a business in an area where the largest competitor charged zero for its goods? Would that affect the price you could charge? The historic assumption is that public lands are supported by general revenues that come from income taxes. Most Americans expect that they will not be charged a user fee for recreation on public lands. But private landowners aren't supported by the general public. They must pay taxes and must charge for the recreational services they provide. And in some areas, the largest competitor charges nothing at all. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.